This is Lorna Canaz on April 4th, 1975, interviewing Evelyn Torton Beck.
My full name that I go under is Evelyn Torton Beck. Actually, I was born without a middle name. I discovered that only American Jews have middle names, and European ones generally do not, but I took my maiden name as my middle name, so I'm now Evelyn Torton Beck. I was born in 1933 in Vienna, Austria. And we lived there for the first 5 years of my life. My father was arrested in 1938 by the Gestapo and was sent to Dachau-Buchenwald. But in those years, it was still possible to get people out, and in 1939 he was released after a lot of pain and effort and money. But when he was released, he had to leave the country virtually immediately, and he went to Italy, and we followed him. So that I lived then in Italy for 1 year, and in 1940, just before the last ship left Italy, we came to this country, New York City, Brooklyn.
Were your parents originally German?
No, my father is Polish. He's a Galician. He's from a small town called Buchach. And he came to Vienna when he was about 15 to make his living, and he actually had been doing very well. He owned his own business. My mother is Czech, and I guess Czechoslovakia and Austria were all part of the same empire, so she was actually native to Vienna at the time.
What business was your father in?
Oh, that's a funny question. He made the skins for, like, Frankfurt, is that casements? That's what you call it in English, casements. That's something we used to talk quite a lot about, and it always struck me as really weird. The skins for Frankfurters, casements, that's what he did.
What kind of animals did they cover?
I think it must have been kosher. I mean, though they're not orthodox. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I don't think they could have been pig casements, but I don't know.
You never know. Do you remember Europe at all?
Yes, very fleetingly. I'm not really sure how much I remember of Vienna from pictures that I've seen and how much is my own memory, but I have very fleeting memories, mostly of things right outside my house. Or seems to me I remember the day he was arrested and the day he came back, but I'm not even sure. But that Italy, I have some slightly less hazy memories about going to school, going to soup kitchens they used to have. My most vivid memory of Italy is eating spaghetti with marmalade they used to give us for lunch. Wasn't too delicious, but somehow.
Were you aware of the crisis? Could you feel the anxiety?
I don't see how I could not have. My mother had to leave her own mother in Vienna, and my father had to leave his sister. While we were in Italy, my father was pretty sick and was in a hospital, and I seem to have memories of just being alone with my brother for hours in this attic. I mean, I must have, though I cannot now actually recall the anxiety. I'm not too eager to either.
How did you get the funds to get out of Italy?
My father had an aunt who had come to this country years before, and her sons had all made good. They all were rich businessmen. And from what I understand from my family, it was the old aunt who had to work long and hard to convince her sons, who after all didn't know the relatives abroad and couldn't have cared less, to give a visa and to give the money. And it's those, actually one of those sons that my father ended up working for in this country. He never again owned his own business.
What language did you speak in?
What country?
Whichever country.
Well, I guess in Italy we must have continued to speak German, though I do recall learning to read and write Italian fluently. I was very good in school. I remember that I spoke Italian. When we came to this country, I think I must have shifted to English very quickly, because I don't think we ever spoke German at home, at least not the children with the parents. I think that they spoke some German to each other, which eventually became bastard English German. But when I started German in junior high school, I learned it like a foreign language. I had never been to school in Austria.
So you didn't speak Yiddish? Did your parents speak Yiddish?
Actually, not. My father, of course, spoke Yiddish, but my mother, being a Viennese Jew, had never learned any Yiddish, and in fact had a very bad attitude toward it. So I learned my Yiddish at the Shalom Aleichem Volksschule, outside the home. And I don't think we ever spoke it in the home at all. I wasn't too eager to speak it with anybody, really, in the days that I was studying it.
Were you aware of any feelings towards you as a Jew in Europe?
In Europe? Well, I mean, again, I'm not sure how much is story and how much is real memory, but certainly, yeah, I do remember, for instance, well, I wasn't allowed to go to school, and there were certain stores we couldn't go into, and there were, like, butter you couldn't buy if you were Jewish. And my mother says, and I have a fleeting recollection, I was very blonde and had a very small nose, and I didn't look Jewish. She would send me to a different neighborhood to buy butter because I didn't look like a Jew, and therefore I could maybe get it. And of course, I do remember that whole, I mean, I used to go with her sometimes to all the offices where they had to stand online and wait for papers and things, and the Nazis were just all over, so surely. But I don't remember anyone ever taunting me with being Jewish or anything like that. I just wasn't allowed to go to the schools when the going got hard.
What did your parents tell you about not being able to do that? They gave no explanation?
I have no recollection. I have the feeling that it was just there, especially once my father was arrested. I mean, let's say I was 5 when he was arrested. I don't know whether I already wasn't going to school, or, you know, even kindergarten or not. But there must have been a lot of talk of it in the house, because my mother said she cried a lot. And I mean, I can't imagine that it just wasn't permeating the whole house. But I really don't remember it.
Where did you come when you came to the United States?
I went to Brooklyn.
That's where your aunts and cousins lived?
No, actually, they lived in the Bronx, but I guess they put us up with some other distant relative who lived way down and near the edge of Brooklyn. It's now all built up, but in those days it was practically the country. And we lived with this woman who I guess had some room in her house, and then we moved and finally ended up with our own apartment in, well, in a slum, but not as bad a slum as they come. And it's called East New York, below Brownsville.
Was that a Jewish neighborhood?
Mixed, largely Jewish, but a lot of Italians and blacks. Now it seems to me to have been a nice neighborhood, but when I was a kid, I was always afraid, especially at night, especially in my hallway.
What kind of Jewish education did you have as a child?
Well, they sent me to various schools, and I suspect that I didn't like them, considering how many I went to. I think I started out at a Talmud Torah, you know, after school, a couple of afternoons, and it seems to me mostly what we learned there was, well, I learned Hebrew, and we learned a lot of prayers by rote, and I can't remember that we really learned much else. And I think I didn't like it, so I transferred from there to various Yiddish schools, and the one that I stayed with was the Shalom Aleichem Volksschule, which was a Yiddish school. We did learn Hebrew too, but its emphasis was Yiddish, and its emphasis was more culture than religion, although we also learned all the prayers and the cultural background and things like that. And so I graduated out of there, but I really hated it, and I really made the life of my Yiddish teacher miserable. And I think my impression is they graduated me out in a big hurry, because I really was very bad. But I think I must have basically liked it in spite of that, because Yiddish always somehow meant something to me. And I mean, I still have essays that I wrote I became a Zionist too in those early years. I joined Hashomer Hatzair, which is the most left-wing movement, and my father was so thrilled that I was doing something really Jewish. He didn't quite notice the fact that it was Hashomer Hatzair. My father is rabidly anti-communist. He's sort of a general Zionist with socialist inclinations, but I loved that. I mean, Hashomer Hatzair, I think, was probably the most formative Jewish influence in my life, in a way. And I was very young when I joined. I was maybe 10. And fell madly in love with all the people running it. And in fact, I was sure I was going to a kibbutz in Israel when I got older. But I guess what happened, why I really quit after a couple of years, was that this one group leader of our group, whom I had a mad crush on, she'd quit the movement, or as they put it that time, she was taking a leave of absence. And she didn't show up, and next time, we didn't wear makeup. I was very modish way before my time, because I think except for 1 or 2 years in junior high, I never have worn makeup. And I think it really comes from Hashomer Hatzair. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't wear makeup. But anyway, when she took a leave of absence from the movement, it seemed to make the whole thing less interesting, and I began to sort of look at it with different eyes. And I did then afterwards go to other Zionist groups, Hanoah Hatzioni and Young Judea and stuff, but they never had the absolute punch that Hashomer Hatzair did. And I still somehow respect their way of doing things. I mean, they're the best organized and most sort of effective kibbutz movement, I think, that there is.
Graduate of Habonim.
I think I may have also taken a quick turn at Habonim, but they were too general for me. I mean, I was going to do it. I liked those uniforms and the whole...
Yeah, uniforms.
Oh, yeah. Oh, just like the German things. Blue skirts for the girls, pants for the boys, white shirts with chulza, you know, and different colors designating what group you were. I remember I went through from the light blue to the light green, and then my dream was it was to have the dark blue that was like for the leaders, but I never made it that far.
What kind of religious affiliations did your parents have?
Well, I guess they always belonged to a temple, but in the early years I didn't know too much about what it was, what kind of a temple it even was. I suspect that it was conservative. I mean, they were never absolutely of the Frimist, but they were, I guess, conservative. I couldn't tell you much about it. I only went when forced on the high holidays. I hated it. My recollection of temple is lots of children running around up and down the steps, women talking upstairs about their new hats, and men, you know, praying more or less downstairs.
This was in New York?
In Brooklyn. I have very little recollection of it. I don't think it had too much to do with their temple. The Hebrew school somehow didn't seem to be attached to the temple, and certainly not that Yiddish school. Mm-hmm. So that I only really went when I absolutely had to.
Was it a German?
No. No, it was made up of the Jews of the neighborhood who were a nice hodgepodge of Russian Jews, Polish Jews, German Jews. I mean, it was a very, very, it was a very colorful neighborhood. When I was a kid, we still had those markets, the Black Avenue markets with push carts. And also, I feel I didn't appreciate those. I used to just hate to go shop in the markets. Now when I go to Europe, oh, I just love the markets. But there I had it right 2 blocks away, and I used to hate it.
The market basket kind of markets?
Well, it was push carts, you know, push carts all over, and there was noise and dirt, and I mean, it was colorful to someone who didn't have to live with it, but I guess to a kid living there, recognizing that this was something poor, something immigrant, I certainly didn't like to go to I used to dream, well, some days we would shop in a store that had the things all neatly laid out. I thought that was really neat.
What was your attitude to the non-Jews in the neighborhood?
It was very benign. Well, they were actually... It's hard to describe. Let me think about it a minute. there were not that many that I was in mm-hmm. close contact with. I mean, I know there was like a Negro family around the corner, and we just had very friendly feelings toward them. I guess there couldn't have been enough. You know, there must have been a few families. I remember one of the major traumas of my life is that a little girl died, one of the little girls, maybe she was six, and we all went to see her laid out, and she was dressed in this gorgeous dress, so we must have been really on good terms with those that were quite around near us. And in school, they had the classes separated according to ability, and I was always in the highest ability class. So I can remember, there were like, I would say out of 35, there were 5 non-Jews, and I always knew exactly who they were. It was one black and one, two, the others were Italian. I still even remember their names, God. And they were like separate, and yet they were friends. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. so there was a kind of a sense of harmony, certainly non-threatening.
Well, did you have any best friends that were not Jewish?
No. No, that, I don't think so. I don't think we really, they lived, you see, I mean, I don't know if you know a city or what is, you know, how it is, but they lived like 10 blocks away in a more Italian neighborhood, because the neighborhood, although, you know, in the large it was mixed, mm-hmm. there were, like, the Italians lived in a certain place more, you know, where they had mm-hmm. their Italian grocery and their Italian market or things. And those 10 blocks were like 50 worlds away. And so I don't think we often, I actually had no best friends who weren't Jewish. And I'm not even sure that we played very often outside together.
What would your parents have said if you had?
Brought home a non-Jewish friend? It's hard to say. I don't think they would have objected as long as it was a girl and I was young enough. I mean, I know what happened mm-hmm. as soon as I started to go out with boys. I mean, you know, that would have been a major, major, major catastrophe. And, you know, and the older I got, the more of a catastrophe it would have been. They would have thrown me out. They would have disowned me, you know, and stuff like that. But as a child, I think it would have been all right. In fact, they spoke of these particular non-Jewish children who were in my class with sort of respect. I think maybe they were awed by the fact that they weren't Jewish, or maybe they were awed by the fact that they weren't Jewish and were still in this special class and were very bright. And, you know, it was just sort of a... I remember one of the kids, my father was a garbage collector, and always... I mean, I haven't forgotten it to this mm-hmm. day. And, you know, she's so bright, and her father is garbage, you know, garbage collector. But I think in the early years, their attitude was reasonably comfortable.
Did they have non-Jewish friends?
Well, in a way, they not close friends, but they always have had people that they are close to in an acquaintanceship way who are not Jewish. We lived in a... over a store, for instance, mm-hmm. and I remember that, well, in fact, the family underneath us, Mrs. Puccio, I still remember her name, lived there for years, and they were Italian, as you can tell by them, and my mother and she were friendly neighbors. Sometimes they quarreled, sometimes they were more like friendly enemies, but there was always a lot of interaction. The guy who owned the store downstairs, Smitty, was also not Jewish, he was Protestant, and there was certainly a lot of contact. My mother always knew what was going on in his family and with his business and with his wife. And, you know, there was always, I don't know if camaraderie is quite the right word, but an ongoing familiar acquaintanceship. Not a friendship, but an ongoing involvement. And that's interesting because I never had thought about it. We moved when I was 16 to a neighborhood near Sheepshead Bay, which is very similar in its own way. It's mixed Italian and Jewish. And the people right next door, a whole house of Italians. And my mother's on those exact terms with that whole family. Never occurred to me. To realize that that has been really an ongoing part of my life, it must be important to them to have some kind of contact. I mean, it just happened mm-hmm. that the people living right next door are Italian, but interesting as I think about it, because in some way my parents are very insulated, and yet I think it's more my mother than my father, actually, who has this interest and curiosity to reach out and be in contact with other cultures. I think my father is much more dogmatically goyim. I mean, that's his basic stance toward the world.
Yes, was there primary contact with other immigrants?
What do you mean, primary contact?
I mean,
you mean like primary friendships? Yes, yes. I would say, well, of course, my parents' friends were of two kinds. Some that the people who settled in the Bronx and New York, which was, you know, the other side of the earth, who were from there, either from Vienna, or who were people that my father had known, not from the old country yet, but mostly they were from Vienna, and those people were very primary friends. But of course, it's a two-hour subway ride, so we didn't see those people that often. And then in the neighborhood, they picked up very close friends who are still their closest friends. In fact, when they moved in the neighborhood, those friends also moved to the same neighborhood.
What I meant was,
and they were immigrants.
They were.
They're all immigrants. Not, yeah. Immigrants.
So you were very aware of the difference between, say, first or second generation?
Oh, yeah. Well, I thought when I was always astounded, my major memory of astoundment is when some kids my own age brought their mothers to school and they sounded like Americans. I couldn't believe a mother who didn't have a foreign accent. I mean, I felt a real split between those kids whose mothers had American accents and those who did not.
But most of the people in your neighborhood of your parents' generation were immigrants then.
And I don't know if most, it was a very mixed neighborhood. No, I don't think probably that most were. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing a head count, but I think in my class, I don't think there were that many immigrant kids. I think it's that my mother and father picked up and became friends with those who were immigrants. I mean, they always did talk about, oh, they're real Americans, with something of a derogatory attitude, you know.
What was that stereotype about?
The real American?
Yeah.
Well, coldness, kind of. First of all, my mother had this thing, and she was that real Americans went to the beauty parlor and always looked gorgeous and cool, real cool, and of course rich, and disdainful of immigrants, and somewhat cold, and self, you know, seeking, or at least looking out for number one. And I guess those were the major, and the lack of sensitivity. Was the feeling I got when she'd say of someone, oh, she's a real American. I mean, that wasn't a praiseworthy statement.
Was there some pressure in your home for you to be a certain way?
Well, I guess I'd have to ask when you have in mind. As a child, it seems to me there wasn't any special pressure that I could think of, except maybe to go to that Hebrew school, or the Jewish school, or the temple, which I didn't much like. But as a teenager, there was tremendous pressure. I mean, as a young teenager, my mother really, and father too, wanted me to be an all right Nick. And that meant going to temple, belonging to a youth group, going out with nice Jewish boys who were middle class and who you know, who were going to be doctors or dentists, and dressing in a conventional and traditional way, and going to places that they approved of, and, you know, sort of being obedient in fitting an image to become like very traditional.
Were there expectations that you would get married? You could go on to school?
That's hard for me. I presume there were expectations that I would get married, though I didn't have a very keen sense of that, except in, I mean, I had, when it came out in a kind of negative way. I remember I had this boyfriend who I was just wild about, and he was exactly my age. We were born on the same day, and I thought that was cool. And when I come home, I remember from being out with him, my mother would be weeping, sitting and weeping. You can't marry him. We were all of 17 or 18. he's exactly your age, what will happen to you? You must marry somebody older, he's, you know, nothing or nobody. So then I began to realize, well, if I went out with someone, that was the next thought on her mind. But I didn't feel it as a pressure to get married. And maybe that's because I was pretty young. And by going to school, oh, by the way, needless to say, with those other expectations, I didn't follow any of them, and I had a very stormy adolescence.
And what did your parents expect you to go on in your education?
To college?
Yes.
I couldn't even say that they did or they didn't. It just seemed to me that that was what I was going to do, and there was never any question about it. I think that it was also understood that I would go to a city school, that I would live at home. There was never any question of my going out of town, but the idea of not going to college just never came up.
Or did they have any input as to what field you would be going into?
No, not really. I talked with them very little about what I was doing or what I was studying. They really just left that all to me.
Did you feel there were things as a woman or as a Jew that you could not do?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because I think that there were vast areas that just never occurred to me that I could do, but I couldn't say that I consciously didn't choose them because I was a woman or a Jew or poor. In other words, there were just certain things that never crossed my mind, but why they didn't cross my mind, I think, was so elemental that it wasn't on a level of consciousness at all. I think that internalization process must have begun a very long time ago. And I don't have any recollection of wanting anything that I then had to say to myself, well, that's not for you because you're this or that. It seems to me, I think what most people do is you tailor your desires fairly much to what the possibilities are.
Did you have the expectation? When did you get your degree?
My college degree. I majored in both English and German. We didn't have any comparative lit program. And that really was what I was interested in already at that time, just the study of literature across national boundaries. And since I couldn't do that, I took a complete major in German and another in English. And then I got a master's from Yale, which originally applied to the German program. I think it was the German program, maybe it was the English, but we found out about this program. I got married my last year of college, and my husband was going to Yale, so we discovered this program of Masters of Arts in Teaching, where you could take subjects in your own area and then also take some teaching courses and do some student teaching, and then you could teach. Mm-hmm. And that seemed very sensible because it seemed finite, and I think I really didn't have my head together enough to do really serious graduate work at that time. And I think it was turned out to be a good thing, but again, I may have made that choice because my husband was still a graduate student. This seemed like a very sensible thing to do. He was going to go on for a PhD, and so if I could get a degree in a year and 2 summers and then work, that would make a lot of sense.
Was your expectation through college that you would end up teaching?
I think my expectation through college was to get through college. I was a pretty mixed up kid, and I don't think I really knew, had a realistic picture of what I would do. Teaching was something I always said I wanted to do. I know that I loved it. When I had been in high school, I had been selected to take my German teacher's place for a day, and it was like the crowning moment of my high school career. But I always knew I wanted to teach, but I had no realistic picture of what you did or how you went about becoming this thing. And I think that was more happenstance than actual planning in those early years. When I then came back to graduate school, after I'd had children and been out, I had a much better sense of what I wanted to do and what I had to do to get it.
When you said as you came into adolescence, your parents were much more adamant about you not, for example, dating non-Jewish boys. How did they put that?
I said, I'll break every bone in your body if you bring home somebody who's not Jewish. I mean, it wasn't any undercover pressure. It was right open. I mean, it was... And they did put a lot of pressure on me toward, I mean, I remember the year that I decided not to fast on Yom Kippur, and in fact, I wanted to go to the theater with a friend of mine, and I said I was going to the theater. And they literally threw me out of the house. I mean, it was a huge, huge fight. And so, I mean, it was a, they made their wishes very clear and knew how to put pressure on to make them come about, more or less. I mean,
what were their reasons?
Their reasons?
I mean, the reasons they gave you.
A nice Jewish girl doesn't go to the theater on Yom Kippur. I mean,
well, and then for not dating Jewish boys. Well, I mean, for not dating Jewish boys.
I don't know that they ever gave any but emotional reasons. That, you know, my sense was that Judaism was one of the most important things to them, mm-hmm. especially to my father, and that he would do everything in his power to maintain the tradition, and that marrying out of it was a total betrayal of the tradition. And that, I mean, I guess I don't know that he actually ever brought up the 6 million as such, but that was always there. All those Jews would have died in vain. It's a going over to the other side.
What did you know about what was happening in Germany?
I mean, when I was in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Or when did you know that?
That's, again, very hard to say. Since my mother had her mother there and my father had his sister, I was certainly aware of tremendous tension and worry about what was going on. But I don't have any recollection of knowing anything concrete. Mm-hmm. For instance, I know, like, my mother had a, what would be called now, I guess, a little minor nervous breakdown at the time when it became clear that the Jews were being deported, that they were in camps. But I don't have any recollection other than that my mother was weeping and just out of commission, and that it had something to do with her mother. But I don't really remember knowing specifically what it was until much later. And then with my father's sister, I knew that she had left Germany and was in Mauritia. God knows, an island, that's where she ended up. And then I know when she went from Mauritia to Palestine, and then she finally came here, and I remember listening to Gabriel Heater, and he was telling about all the ships that were sunk, and my parents thinking my aunt was on that ship and sitting and crying and saying, well, that's it. But it was all, I don't know that I specifically, and I certainly went to the movies and must have seen all those things about the Germans, but I don't have any real recollection of putting it all together. I don't remember hearing about the camps. I mean, I'm sure I must have, but I must have just sort of pushed that away from having anything to do with me specifically or my family. My father also had a sister and brother-in-law who were all eventually killed. So it must have been in the house quite a bit, but I don't remember it.
I was interested in what possibly people were doing to get them out, if there was any kinds of organizations or...
I'm sure there were, but I don't have any special recollection of my parents working with them. They may have gone downtown and stood on lines, but that was something that I didn't have any part in, really, and that they didn't talk to me about.
Go back to, what did your parents say about Jews who married non-Jews?
Well, they spoke about it with great derision, and as I said, they felt that was just a really bad thing, and that, I mean, they never spoke about it in logical, I mean, I would say this in summing up my parents' attitude toward everything having to do with anything Jewish, it's totally irrational and totally emotional and very powerful.
Did you know any yourself when you were growing up?
When I was growing up? Well, actually, it's funny, now that I think about it, my mother's best friend in Vienna, who remained in Vienna through the war, was married to a non-Jew. Like, two of my mother's closest girlhood friends, who both remained in Vienna, both made it through the war, had been married to non-Jews, and they still remained my mother's best friends. In fact, they have seen them since, and I visited them since. So that's a strange kind of a contradiction. I mean, they obviously, I did know of some, but it was always, I mean, my mother would say about so-and-so, oh, he's very nice, but he's not Jewish, you know. I mean, I guess the fact that they had married non-Jews, I guess in the case of their close friends, was somewhat rationalized.
What would happen if a Jewish girl in your neighborhood or within your circle of friends had gotten pregnant and was not married?
Had gotten pregnant and was not married? It didn't happen, so it's a little hard to... I think it would have been, A, hushed up as much as possible. I mean, that was my mother's big fear, right? A shanda for the neighbors, right? It was looked up, I mean, I was always given to understand that this was like the worst thing that could possibly happen. And of all the reasons that you shouldn't go to bed with somebody, that was the major one. I think it would have been hushed up as much as possible. I don't think there would have been any ostracism or anything like that, but it would have been hidden. So that, you know, very few people would know about it.
How did you feel about women who went into traditionally male occupations, like going to medical school or something?
I didn't know any.
You didn't know any at all?
As a child? Not at all, not that I can... No. I don't think I really did. I really had very few, I mean, role models, or just, there was, I don't think I knew anybody like that.
Can you look back and see what your attitude would have been?
Well, you're talking about as an adolescent, I think I had tremendous admiration for women who were, and I don't know if it was, I guess any major professional accomplishment would have been a non-traditional field for a woman. I think I had tremendous admiration. I mean, when I was a kid or a young adolescent, Mary McCarthy was my role ideal, and or somebody like Simone de Beauvoir, but it was Mary McCarthy because I used to read all her things and follow her. But I think it would have been great admiration. I mean, see, from my own home, for instance, I know that my mother talked a great deal about, well, she's an extremely intelligent woman, but that she was not allowed to go to school past 14 or 15. Well, actually, maybe they even sent her to 16, making an extra special effort because she was very poor. Her father had died. She had to support herself and her mother. So she went to a business school and worked as a secretary or a bookkeeper or something, and then till she got married. But there was always a tremendous sense of admiration on her part for anything professional, and that my sense was that she wished very much that she could have been rich enough to have been sent to the university. And they did tell me, now that I think about it, if we had stayed in Vienna, they would have sent me to the University of Prague, because my father's sister was living in Prague, and that was their plan for me, that I would have gone to Prague. So I guess there was a tremendous sense of, in my growing up, of loss for someone who didn't do this. And I guess my earliest memory is of thinking what a waste my mother's life was, because she's an exceptionally intelligent woman, exceptionally, and totally unrealized most of her abilities.
Did she feel it was a waste?
Did she?
Does she?
Well, I mean, it's very threatening, right, to actually face it head on. I think she does, when she focuses on it in and of itself, but she doesn't. I mean, what she says is, you know, in those years and those times and Hitler and, you know, everything, I mean, which is, of course, perfectly accurate in some ways. But I think, basically, she perceives it as a loss.
When did you first become interested in some of the ideals of a women's movement, for example, not possibly unorganized?
Oh, well, actually, an interesting thing is I came to them very long ago, and I had no idea of a movement. I just see what happened to me was that, okay, I got married, got this master's, got pregnant, never did work. Our plans went aglay. I got pregnant, and so my husband had a... I mean, in those years, it never occurred to us that I could still go out and get a job and that he could be a graduate student and take care of the baby. I mean, it just was, never entered our mind. So I got pregnant, I had to stay home, he had to go out and work, and which he did, which wasn't any too great for any of us, but... And he did finish his doctorate, and I stayed home and was miserable. I mean, right away, like from the first second, I knew that... Well, I knew it even before I had a kid, because one of the things that we'd always talked about before we ever got married was, I'm not just going to be a housewife. I knew that that was not for me, but you just somehow don't always make those connections. So I was pretty unhappy right away, but circumstances being what they were, it was a few years till I had my second kid, that, and we came to Madison, that I began to see my life opening up before me as a... Because between the two kids, we traveled, we were in Europe, and we lived in New Orleans. So there was always something doing, and we were sort of, I guess, furthering my husband's career, right? And I was the good wife and mother, or not so good, but I was doing my job as best I could. And when we came to Madison, and this was his job, and this was my life, and my second kid was 1 year old, I realized immediately that it was up or out. I mean, that I really was very unhappy. And I just went back to school against my husband's better judgment. And I, for the next 10 years, I was a graduate student and a TA, and there was no movement. And in fact, I lived at university houses. And I think that, though I chose not to notice it, there was a fair amount of public disapproval. Because I'd get a housekeeper in and, you know, go off to work and so on. And so I was doing, I mean, I was just finding my way long before there was any organized women's movement. And I mean, I just somehow knew what I had to do to save myself and to make myself be the person I wanted to be.
So was there a lot of guilt connected with that?
Well, strangely enough, there wasn't. And I think that the reason that there wasn't, it was just... I mean, people used to say in those years, I remember, very admiring, I don't know how you do it, have you a house and a husband and the children. I said, don't admire me, I must. I mean, it was such a sense of, I mean, I had such a clear picture that it was a life-saving thing that I really don't think I had any guilt. I mean, it was just so clear to me it was, you know, that it was me or them, that the choice didn't seem to me to be, you know, that there was no room for guilt in such a clear choice.
Did you have problems with getting into graduate programs because of your...
No, I didn't have any trouble getting in. I started out as a special student or as a, you know, very part-time student, and I went into a small department where I did very well. I got a TA-ship right away, but I guess there was a whole combination of the department needed me, and I must say that I was totally unaware of any prejudice against me as a woman while I was a graduate student. Now, I think that's probably not true. I think I got somewhat less money than other people in terms of being pushed for fellowships, but I had my teaching assistantships, which I loved. And
which graduate department was this?
I was here, incomplete. And then I took courses in German and English, but I was incomplete. The only moment of real prejudice came when I was almost finished and most of the work was behind me. One of my professors said something about, what are you going to do now that you're finished? And I said, well, get a job, of course. And he looked at me and said, really? And I said, well, what did you think I was going to do after slaving for 10 years on this goddamn dissertation? He said, well, I thought you were just doing it for a hobby. And that's when I somehow realized that they had, that this particular one, in any case, had not really taken my work seriously. I was astounded because I knew how much hard work it had been. Anyway, so I commuted to a job from here for the very same reasons before, I mean, this was about 5 years ago, before it became a more established, or it's not enough, it's established, but it's certainly more uncommon than it was then thing to do. So I guess I would say that I really only became aware that there was a women's movement into which I could hook in relatively recently. I mean, it's been a growing thing, but I'd say that maybe within the last...
And there seem to be very few women, academic women, in the women's movement.
Well,
do you feel that you've really been insulated from by being in an academic atmosphere?
No, not at all. Well, I guess traditionally there aren't that many academic women in the movement, but I find a tremendous sort of groundswell of support from, I guess, a lot of junior faculty and a lot of graduate students, so I don't really feel insulated at all. I mean, I have the feeling that it's right there, right in the academy, and that it will grow, but...
The feeling in the women's movement is that women in academia, at least up until very recently, have sold out.
Well, an awful lot, I don't know if it could say selling out, but it does seem to me that an awful lot of women who go through the period of time it takes to get to PhD, get there, you know, you begin to think in certain ways, and by the time you're done, you've bought everything that you maybe tentatively held until that time.
What kind of pressures?
Pressures? Well, I mean, pressures to do graduate work in a certain way, to think in certain ways, to write papers in certain ways, to do a certain kind of, that a certain kind of research is important versus another, and that you should behave in certain ways. I mean, I was, for instance, by my advisor very much told I should dress in certain ways, and I shouldn't be too flamboyant, and I should this, and I should that, and I internalized that for quite a long time. Till, well, not a long time, but a few years while I was a graduate student, and only as I grew more confident that I could make it in my own way did I shed a lot of that. And I think there are a lot of people who don't ever shed that.
Do you think the pressures are the same?
Yeah? Oh, yeah. Except that there is this groundswell of people doing it differently, and therefore the person who doesn't want to do it that way isn't as alone. But since the powers that be still have the power, by and large, I think things have not changed tremendously. And if someone wants to do a dissertation, I'm seeing this happen now, a friend of mine doing a critical biography of a woman writer, and I've been watching the criticisms that her male, all-male jury of a committee puts on her, and it's just clear to me that they don't value what this woman has done, they don't really believe the woman writer, that they don't believe her work is worth re-evaluating, and they're putting pressures on my friend to write a dissertation which is not the one that I would direct if that were my student. And it's clear it has everything to do with the traditional male attitudes toward that particular writer.
Is lit a department that is usually dominated by males? Has it been?
Not as much as some others. There are a fair number of women. Languages have always had a fair number of women, and Comp Lit is a spin-off of language departments in a way. But of course the people in power in the, let's say, the nationwide organization by and large have until recently been men, and the kind of women that they now have in there are, might as well be men in their thinking and in their tradition-bound ways.
I guess that's the kind of women the women's movement.
Yeah. And I couldn't see it so much as selling out as they've never been anywhere else. And that they're very loath to let go of the kinds of values that they've...
The image is a very pretty frog with long eyelash sitting on a heap of smelling dung, which is the cream. Do you think that... Do you see those pressures changing, especially with the limited hiring?
I mean, by changing, you mean loosening up? Well, ask me in a few years and I'll really let you know, because I see that, I mean, I don't have a totally nationwide accurate picture, but my sense is things are definitely beginning to change and are beginning to happen. Now, the last place that they're going to be happening is at Wisconsin. So I don't have a very good sense of how really widespread and how many of the people who are doing things differently are actually getting tenure. You know, I know some do and have, but it's hard for me to assess realistically. Certainly, judging from my own experience, I say it must be changing because I'm doing what makes sense to me, and it seems to be respected, and I seem to be having success with it. But of course, when the chips are really down, I'll have a much better way of knowing. You know, and no individual case will prove it one way or the other, but it will be an indication.
With your interest in Yiddish literature, how has that been accepted by universities?
Well, I mean, I think when I was looking for a job initially, it cut me out of a lot of jobs. People looked at it, and either they were anti-Semites, or else they just viewed Yiddish as some subsidiary, very specialized thing with very limited interest. But I think at Wisconsin, it's helped. You know, it's been very widely accepted, mainly because we've had students showing great interest in the course, and the establishment is nothing if not pragmatic. So, my sense is, what was your question again?
How the university establishment viewed something as so Jewish as Yiddish?
As Yiddish. Well, as I say, it's now being taught at a lot of campuses, and I think that it's being viewed as a more viable academic thing. That sort of whole thing's happening. The establishment of this linguistics department at Columbia, which has very well-known and respected linguists running it. Other linguists have gotten into it. A lot of non-Jews have gotten into it. So that I think it is becoming more and more an academic discipline in a without the stigma of being specialized. And I think with the growth of interest in ethnic minority groups in general, this has made Yiddish seem less special, because if you have Chicano studies, Indian studies, you know, Yiddish has a place there. And in that way, I think it's becoming more and more accepted.
It's interesting that most of the people in the Yiddish literature class seem to be quite assimilated and unaware of the backgrounds at times.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think that my sense is that American youth is looking for roots and origins, and those who are even minimally Jewish are once again interested in their past.
Tell me some of the experiences you had with working with Singer, translating. What kind of person was he?
Well, extremely charming, extremely pleasant to work with, I found. I don't know whether all the translators found that to be so. Very listening to my opinion, and willing to take criticism and advice. And very easy to be with. I mean, he's a good talker, and he knows how to get people to talk. And I don't know that I have any astounding stories or anecdotes to tell. We just had a very, very comfortable working relationship. I mean, we spent about 2 days a week with him. And we would work, and we'd go for walks, and we'd eat lunch, or we'd just, you know, talk. And I don't really know if I can think of even any anecdotes.
How did it happen that he came to University of Wisconsin?
Well, he was offered this Rennebaum professorship, a writer in residence. They have money set aside for certain things. And I guess, what's his name? Rideout, Walter Rideout, who was the chairman of the English department at that time. What is really interesting, if you want to know, is how I met him. And I think this is absolutely, any of it sounds in this? I mean, to me, it's worth a story in and of itself. I was at that time writing my dissertation, Kafka and the Yiddish theater, influence of Yiddish theater on Kafka. And my husband used to ride home with Walter Rideout, and we knew the Rideouts, you know, not well, but, and he, when Walter Rideout one day mentioned that Singer was coming, my husband said, oh, he said, Evie will be interested in him because she's doing her dissertation on Yiddish theater and Kafka. And Rideout said, okay, well, that's nice, I'll invite her when he comes. And much to my great surprise, the day that Singer arrived, bright up, said, why don't you and Anatole come up and have dessert with us? So it was really neat. He had just arrived. We were the only ones there besides Walter and his wife. And he lives right up the hill, so we dropped by for coffee. We began to talk, and Singer began asking me about my work. And I said, well, I'm doing this work. I said, I'm writing. And I started, of course, I was very much into it. I started to tell him about this Yiddish actor that Kafka had known. I said, obviously a very obscure person, nobody ever heard of him. And Singer sort of looked at me and said, well, I knew that man. Not only did I know that man, but I have just finished writing a short story in Yiddish about that man. It's called A Friend of Kafka. And, I mean, if you know that Singer believes in the spirits, he believes in sort of guiding things. I mean, it was just one of these astounding things that can only happen, you know, not very often, because, I mean, I was just shocked that this person was real to say, I think I had just written a story about him. And he said, well, in fact, I have the story is being translated into English, but I have it with me in Yiddish. If you would like, I'll read it to you in Yiddish. And I said, oh, I'll be thrilled. And he said, come to my room tomorrow. So I was there, and he read it to me in Yiddish, and I laughed. I mean, his stuff in Yiddish is very much funnier. He had a tremendously good sense of humor and playful way with words. So he read it to me, and I laughed and laughed and loved it. And I guess he liked me. And he said, how would you like to be my translator? And I said, fine, you're on. I was supposed to be writing my dissertation, but I mean, that was a detour well worth taking. And so I started to go up to his place, and we worked twice a week. But I mean, the idea that we met through this Yitzchok Levy, this obscure Yiddish actor who Kafka knew, and that Singer knew him too. Now you have to read the story of Friend of Kafka. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a delightful story, and Kafka is mentioned in it, as it is this whole cast of characters that I was tracing through in doing my graduate work. I mean, I was, you know, digging into these obscure records. I was fascinated by it, but I surely never thought anyone else would ever have heard of them. So it was a really
It was interesting that there were a lot of people in the Jewish community who didn't even know that Singer was here.
Really? Public lectures.
So he didn't keep himself insulated? Or what?
No, he went to at least two of them. He gave a public lecture at the library. Mm-hmm. He gave a public lecture at the university. I don't know that he spoke at any of the temples, but...
This was what year was it?
67, 68. I only think in academic
years. Who else have you worked with that you've enjoyed?
Well, I haven't translated anybody else. I mean, that was just my special thing. Translation is, I have translated from German, but not from Yiddish. It's a lot of hard work, and actually I did some stuff after he left that he sent me, but it was much too much work for what it gave me. I decided that working with him was a real joy. Actually, working with somebody is a lot more fun than working by yourself.
What happens if you translate something and you show it to the author? Does it always happen that you've translated in the spirit that they wrote it?
Well, of course not. But with Singer, what was so nice is, I guess, I thought I talked about this in class. It was really a dialectical process. That is, we'd sit together, and the first draft I would do right while he was there. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't like something, I would change it, or talk about it, or he would even change the story if he didn't like it. Then I would take it home and type it up, because I usually write in longhand. And then I would go back the next day, and we would read through the draft and make more changes. And this was done about two or three times. And I was at liberty to change things at home that I didn't like the way that it came out, but it was a real process of, you know, talking about the language and the story and the kind of just so. And with Singer, I mean, the stuff that I did for him when I was here, he didn't, or some of it was either not accurate or not in the spirit, so he gave it to somebody else who was there, and they worked on it some more. This he does quite a lot. He will, you know, use more than one translator to do a particular story.
Your specialty is not translation, but teaching.
My specialty?
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard question to answer. I mean,
have a lot of special for your interests. Well, my interests are beginning. I was one of the things I really was worried about for a while, because I didn't see how I could give any of them up, and I didn't see how I could quite reconcile them. Mm-hmm. My interest when I have to write for the MLA, I'm a Kafka scholar. That's mm-hmm. pretty established, and I'm truly still interested in Kafka. And I like to teach him. I'm interested in women's things, literature, women's literature, and women in literature. I'm interested in Yiddish literature, and this, when I say these areas, I mean both teaching them and writing mm-hmm. in them, or giving lectures and professional things in them. And then translation is my fourth area of interest, and mm-hmm. you know, and pedagogy really, which also interests me. I've done a lot of experimentation. See, I teach German sometimes, so then that's a whole other area. When I do something, I like to fool around and see what I can do with it to make mm-hmm. it more interesting, lively, or productive. So I have about five real areas of interest, but I guess my guts right now are with the things having to do with women and the thing having to do with Yiddish. I mean, and those two seem to be converging more than I would have thought. As you see in the mm-hmm. class, there is a certain amount of overlap, and I have the feeling that I'm going to be working my way towards writing something about that convergence, but mm-hmm. not yet.
Do you see a real connection between Jewish attitudes towards women and some of the women's movements? You said those two things are...
The thing, that the convergence that I see is the position of Yiddish in the Jewish community and the position of women in the world at large. It's more of a... Mm-hmm. negative. What I'd like to do is show some parallels and show the whole position of women in the traditional culture and the position mm-hmm. of Yiddish and how what that has meant.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've had that in mind for quite a few years, but I don't quite know how I'm going to put it together.
Have you done any creative writing as opposed to, say, expository writing? I think I heard you say you don't do that.
Not in my grown-up years, no. I'm thinking of keeping an autobiography. And I told you, since I got interested in autobiography. In fact, a friend and I have a project, which we may really do someday. We will write a joint autobiography, a very close friend, one of my oldest friends. And we have this all planned out, that I would write part of her autobiography, and she would write part of mine, of what we know from each other.